For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
This is the second to last week in our study of the early chapters of Genesis. Genesis, of course, being the first book of the Bible. The word Genesis meaning beginnings. And we've seen how even the first three chapters of Genesis deliver some really crucially important revelation about the beginning of our world, the beginning of human beings, the beginning of what God calls sin, which is simply the choice to turn away from the one true God as the reference point and most important relationship in our lives, and instead turn in on ourselves to be that reference point. And we saw how God predicted that when we make that turn away from Him and into self, then it's going to result in injury to ourselves and others. That's called death in the early chapters of Genesis. And we saw the unrolling, the beginning of the unrolling of that death on many levels. We also saw, and this is really probably the most important book, certainly a verse certainly in the early chapters of Genesis, but probably in the whole book of Genesis, that God, immediately after Adam and Eve revolted following the serpent's direction, uttered a promise to them. He said, I will put enmity or conflict between you, Eve, those who descend from you and follow your choice to come back to me, and I'm sorry. He says to the serpent, I'll put enmity between your seed, that is, humans who continue to follow the serpent's advice to be our own gods. I'm going to put enmity between those folks and your seed, the people who come back to faith in God like Eve did. And then God makes this cryptic reference to a future male descendant of Eve's. He, that's the Hebrew singular masculine, a certain male descendant from Eve will bruise you, will bruise the serpent on the head, will destroy him, will crush him. And you, referring to the serpent, you'll bruise him on the heel. You will injure him, but he will defeat you. This verse is like the headwaters of what becomes a mighty stream of predictive information about this coming one, the seed or descendant of Eve, who is later also called the Messiah, God's anointed ruler, the coming one. And so he issued that prediction, that promise, and then we saw again, that the beginning of what God calls the two humanities, these two groups of people, those who follow the serpent's direction and look to self as the center versus those who follow the one true God. We saw the culmination of one of those humanities gaining the upper hand. In Genesis 6, it says the human race became thoroughly corrupt. God stepped in preventatively and began again with Noah and his descendants. And we studied that last week. And tonight we're going to look at another beginning, the beginning of what I will call the Babel Project. We read in Genesis 11:1, now the whole earth, or the whole of humanity is what it means, after the flood, beginning to repopulate, the whole earth used the same language and the same words. This is a repetitive for emphasis. They all had the same language. And it came about as they journeyed east that they found a plain, a level place in the land of Shinar, and they settled there. Well, so Shinar would be, I'll just show you both, over in this area. They had been up here, and they journeyed east to Shinar, the plain of Shinar. And then it says, they said to one another, Come, let us build bricks and burn them thoroughly. And so they used brick for stone, or instead of stones, and they used tar, bitumen, for mortar. We know that in this region, even to today, there are vast tar pits. And so he says they just used that sticky black stuff in place of mortar. And they said, come, let us build for ourselves a city and a tower whose top will reach into heaven, and let us make for ourselves a name, otherwise we will be scattered abroad over the face of the earth. Well, the Lord came down to see the city and the tower which the sons of men had built. This is an anthropomorphism. It doesn't mean that God, you know, is a finite creature living on Mars and he had to get in his spaceship and come down after he got a text from someone. It's actually an ironic, sarcastic language. It's like they're thinking they're building something so, you know, huge and magnificent. He's kind of got to get down on his hands and knees, so to speak, to look at it, because from his perspective, it's pretty small potatoes. He came down to see it. The Lord said, behold, they're one people, and they all have the same language, and this is what they began to do. But now nothing which they purpose will be impossible for them. Come, let us go down there and there confuse their language so that they will not understand one another's speech. So the Lord scattered them abroad from there over the face of the inhabited earth, of the whole earth, and they stopped building the city. Therefore, its name was called Babel. Babel is the Hebrew word for confusion. Therefore, its name was called Babel. We'll come back to this. It's a very ironic ending. Because there the Lord confused the language of the whole earth, and from there the Lord scattered them abroad over the face of the whole earth. So this is the city of Babel, the Tower of Babel. Most of us have at least heard of this story in the Old Testament. We want to look at it and answer these three questions. Did this really even happen at all? And if it did, then why was God so upset with what they were doing? Think how upset he would be with Manhattan if he was upset with this. Why was he upset? And how does this event fit into God's plan for humanity? Because remember, this is the book of the beginning of God's plan for humanity. First of all, did this really happen? I remember growing up having this story ridiculed in school and having it frankly ridiculed at church. In the few times that I went, I heard the minister refer to this and chuckle and say, well, it's just a myth, you know. Just need to look for the moral of the story. I think that's not an intellectually honest conclusion. We know, for example, that all of this book of Genesis claims to be a historical narrative referring to specific people and places and times. And yes, we can begin to confirm a lot of what Genesis refers to beginning in chapter 12. But that doesn't mean that the portion prior to chapter 12 isn't historical narrative. The author sure asserts that he is. So it would be more honest to say he's lying. You know, it's one thing when you say I'm about to tell you a mythical story. It's another thing when I assert to you this really happened when I know that it didn't really happen. We know that the New Testament alludes to this as a historical event. We saw this verse last week when Paul, speaking to the philosophers in Athens, said God made from one man, referring to Noah, after the flood, he made from one man every nation of mankind to live on all the face of the earth, having determined their appointed times and the boundaries of their habitation. So He's referring to the descendants of Noah and this division of humankind into ethno-linguistic nations. And he's asserting to the philosophers there, you know, this is part of what God's done, how he's dealt with humanity. He's referring to it as history. We also have some extra-biblical confirmation about the historicity of this city and this event. Not direct, not a lot. There's not a lot of information, period, about this period. But we have some. In the previous chapter, as Moses is narrating the descendants of Noah's three sons, he says in verse 8, "Now Cush became the father of Nimrod. At the beginning of Nimrod's kingdom was Babel and Erech and Akkad and Calna in the land of Shinar." So this is the same region that we read about. "And from that land, Nimrod went forth into Assyria," that was to the north, "and he built Nineveh and Rehoboth-ur and Calah and Rezin," which lay between Nineveh and Calah. That's the great city. Well, we know about Nineveh. We have archaeological evidence of Nineveh going way back. We also know about this town called Calah, which does not exist any longer. There have been cuneiform writings excavated which refer to this Calah as Calchu, and they are very ancient. We find also in another document saying that this is close by the present city of Nimrud, which is 20 miles south of Nineveh. So there's some fragmentary evidence, ancient reference to some of these cities. We know that there are other very ancient accounts of this event that differ in some details, but which are clearly referring to the same event. This memorial stone was excavated in this region. It's been dated to 2100 BC, so that would be the time of Abraham. This is way before that. And on this stone, we read this commemoration, the construction of this tower. In other words, the tower that this stele represents or calls to mind. The construction of this tower highly offended all the gods. In a night, they threw down what man had built and impeded their progress. They were scattered abroad, and their speech was now strange. So just as we saw with the great flood, there are, in that case, dozens and dozens of very ancient stories about a great flood and a man and his family who were rescued through a boat. We also have non-biblical references to this event that go back a long way. And we have excavated ziggurats. Ziggurats are towers. This is a representation of ancient Babylonian ziggurats. We know that in the day of Nebuchadnezzar. Now Nebuchadnezzar was in the 600s BC, so it was much later. But we know that when he built his empire, he built ziggurats like this in every one of his major cities. They were step towers, almost like pyramids, at the top of which were temples dedicated to the zodiac and astrological tables. What's interesting is that we have references from that time that tell us that Nebuchadnezzar was building his ziggurats based on a pattern that they knew about that was way, way, way before them in Babylon. So Gleason Archer summarizing, or this is Alan Ross in his article, says every important city of Nebuchadnezzar's Babylonia was built with a step tower known as a ziggurat. In his day, Babylon, there was a seven-story tower with a temple top that was known as Etemenanki. But we know that the first of such towers must be earlier than Nebuchadnezzar's, for his were built on rebuildings of ancient patterns. So again, nothing that I've cited like proves beyond a shadow of a doubt that the event that we read is in history. If you were going to adopt that level of skepticism, unless we have historical proof, we won't believe in ancient assertions about what happened. You couldn't know anything about history. This is really pretty good for something this old, that it backs up the Bible's claim that this event actually happened. The whole human language, the whole human race, originally after the flood, had one language. They began a project that was impeded and prevented by the scattering of their languages, the separating of their languages. And we can, of course, trace language families back very far. Well, why was God so upset? I mean, the account almost makes God sound like he's got a fragile ego. You know, if they've done this, if they build a skyscraper, they may not need me pretty soon. And that he lashes out of his own insecurity. That is not at all what's going on here. And this is a great example of when you read a passage, when you read the whole book, so that you're familiar with what's become before this, the author's assuming that you're familiar with it, what he's already said, that when you come to it, the pieces start to fit into place pretty easily. If you deal with it in an isolated way, you'll be confused. First of all, as we saw in chapter 10, Babel was founded by this character named Nimrod, right? He was the son of Cush. He became a mighty one on the earth. Nimrod comes from an ancient verb that means to rebel. So it's probably the name that he took for himself. I will rebel. And it says he was a mighty one on the earth. He was a great ruler. He was a mighty hunter before the Lord. This does not mean that he hunted for trophies to dedicate to God. The word before means in the face of or in defiance of. Somehow, whatever hunting he was engaged in, some scholars suggest that he hunted for people. Hunted people down who opposed him. We don't know for sure. But we know that his name was I Will Rebel. And what he did in defiance of the Lord. That's why Moses says, it said like Nimrod, a mighty hunter before the Lord. Well, I haven't seen that bumper sticker for a while. Faded out. And then we read about the beginning of his kingdom. So this city was started by a man who was committed to defy God. You say, well, what did they know about that God wanted them to do that they would defy? Well, that's the second point. The text tells us that they built this city in direct defiance of God's command to spread out and fill the earth. We saw last week after the flood in Genesis 9, verse 1 and verse 7, God says, now fill the earth, have babies, and fill the earth, spread out. I want you to spread out. And so we read, though, their decision. They said, come, let us build for ourselves a city. In other words, let's all stay right here. Otherwise, we'll be scattered abroad over the face of the whole earth. We know that's what God wants us to do. We will not do that. We will rebel and pool our resources right here. You say, well, why would God want them to spread out? Well, again, if you read the early chapters, you know that when they were all in one place before and hanging out and interacting, it says that they became so morally and spiritually corrupt that they were in danger of destroying themselves. God does not want that to happen again. You know that old phrase, strong fences make good neighbors. He wanted them to had a little space between them. Thirdly, we read that their express purpose or motivation in building this city was their own self-aggrandizement. They said, come, let us build for ourselves a city and a tower whose top will reach into heaven, and let us make for ourselves a name. We've seen that phrase before. We saw that Cain, after he went out from the presence of God to do his own thing, after he killed his godly brother, one of the first things he did was to build a city for his descendants and name it after his son. I'm going to build a legacy by naming a city after my son. Making a name for yourself is a biblical expression for exalting yourself in an ungodly way. So that's what we're going to do. And lastly, we're pretty sure that this tower is not like they literally were trying to go up into the sky. If they'd have wanted to do that, they wouldn't have built this down in a low elevation plain. There were mountains around there that they could have at least given them a good head start. The idea isn't literally to go up into the sky. The heavens refers to the dwelling of the gods. And that's why Nebuchadnezzar's ziggurats, as I said, were all dedicated to astrological worship. And the case is very strong that that's what this was about, too. They wanted to, even now, false gods. They were in contact with false gods, which the Bible later calls evil spirits. And we're trying to contact them, channel them, use their power and energy to resource their own project. That's what all occultic spirituality does. It's an attempt to harness the spirit realm or the spirits to bring them under our control to enable us to do what we've decided we will do. And that's what they were into. So it's a pretty sinister project, if you think about it from the perspective of the biblical story. So we're headed right back to what it was like in the days of Noah. That's where we're headed. By the way, this is why God, later when he brings the Israelites into their country, he says, beware that you don't lift your eyes to heaven and see the sun and the moon and the stars, all the host of heaven, and be drawn away to worship them and serve them. It's again not referring to astronomy, but to astrology and the spiritual presuppositions of astrological worship. And God's like, that's out of order. You don't need to do that. Because I'm the one true God. You don't need to try to control everything because your safety is in following my direction. Don't go down that path. It's pretty relevant even today. And so what this was an attempt to unite humanity for the first time. The Babel Project, what is it? It's the attempt to unite humanity under one human ruler. In this case, Nimrod, in defiance of God, the one true God, and in defiance of his plan. That's what this is. And so when God says, hey, they're all together and they've all got the same language, and if this is what they've begun to do, if they've just started and they've already made this amount of progress in rebelling and deifying themselves, now nothing which they purpose to do will be impossible to them. He's saying, this is a warning statement. He's saying, when human beings in their fallen state unite under a godless ruler and harness their great powers and resources, what they will do is there'll be an explosion of evil and of inhumanity to people. And all manner of corruption. And that's clearly what God means, because he says, that's why I'm going to go down and prevent this project from succeeding. He frustrates their plan, and he forces them to spread out into different ethno-linguistic nations. He said, let's go down and confuse their language so they will not understand one another's speech. Just imagine if you were on the building project, you're part of the crew, And you're up there on the scaffold as a foreman, and you yell down to someone, you know, send up another load of bricks. And he looks up at you and it's like, parlez-vous français? Right? And so you yell at someone else and they're like, ich kann Englisch nicht sprechen. Think what it would be like if all of a sudden people's language changed. What would happen? Well, you wouldn't be able to work with the ones that you couldn't understand, right? And that would do any project some detriment. And you would also then have to find the people who spoke the language you now spoke, and you'd have to stick with them to get anything done. And that's what this passage said God did. He didn't wipe them out. He ingeniously incentivized their spreading out. So the Lord scattered them abroad from there over the face of the whole earth, and they stopped building the city. Therefore, its name was called Babel. Now, in the ancient Babylonian language, Babel means gate of the gods. That was the name they gave to this project. We're building a gate of the gods. But Moses points out to his Israelite audience, in our language, that means confusion. So it's irony, it's sarcasm. God made Babel into a Babel, B-A-B-B-L-E, right? God confused, frustrated their project because there the Lord confused the language of the whole earth, and from there the Lord scattered them abroad over the face of the whole earth. And that is the account of the beginning of the Babel project. Let's spend our remaining time then focused on this third question. What does this event have to do with God's overall plan? Remember that the Bible is the disclosure of a plan that God has for humanity. Not only an original plan, which humanity turned from, but God's rescue plan or rescue operation. And as we consult the immediate context and as we consult the rest of the Bible, it gives us at least two answers to this question. One answer that it gives us is that Babel, this event and what the project that they were embarked on, represents a motif that you see recurring throughout human history. Just right through human history, you see this motif, this impulse for a ruler to arise, to build an empire under their authority, and to try to unify, by conquest usually, the rest of the world. This empire building is one of the main themes of fallen human history. And that's why I titled this teaching The Beginning of the Babel Project, because this is an evil impulse according to the Bible, and it didn't go away after their languages were confused. We see this, for example, even the term Babel or Babylon becomes a code name for this motif, this perspective. Neo-Babylon, that's what we call Nebuchadnezzar's Babylon. Again, 600s BC. It arises under the leadership of Nebuchadnezzar. He launches out and conquers virtually all of the peoples in the known world. We know that he was a godless man, an egomaniac. Lots written about him in the Bible and out. And at a certain point, God utters a predictive word against Babylon, like he did here in the book of Isaiah, 100 years or so before. God says to Isaiah, take up this taunt against the king of Babylon and say to him, oh, how the oppressor has ceased and how fury has ceased. You full of fury and oppression of the people that you conquer. The Lord has broken the staff of the wicked one, the scepter of rulers who used to strike the peoples in fury with unceasing strokes, which subdued the nations in anger and with unrestrained persecution. And then God peers right into the heart of this man who doesn't even live yet and says, "You said in your heart, I will ascend to heaven. I will raise my throne above the stars of God. I will sit on the Mount of Assembly in the recesses of the north. I will ascend above the heights of the clouds. I will make myself like the Most High." That's called self-deification. That's called a bad case of self-aggrandizement. And God says this because this is the motivation driving your empire building. He says, "Nevertheless, you'll be thrust down into Sheol, into the pit, to the very recesses of the pit." And several times then in Jeremiah and Isaiah, we hear God saying, another Babylon is going to rise up under the leadership of another Nimrod with the same motivation, the same aspirations, and I'm going to prevent them from succeeding in their project. And of course, in this case, God prevented Babylon from their project by bringing the Media Persians in to conquer them. And he predicted that as well. We think about in the days of the first century. Rome was an empire by this time, began as a republic, but now was an empire led by Caesar's emperors, who by this time were beginning to view themselves as deity and were about to require that although you could worship any other god that you wanted to, you were going to have to burn incense to Caesar and worship Caesar as a god. And this is why when Peter, who's writing from Rome about 60 AD, and who will later be crucified upside down by Emperor Nero, as he ends his first letter, he says, "She who is in Babylon, chosen together with you, sends you greetings, as does my son Mark." This is the "she" is most likely a reference to the church in Rome. And she says, you know, the church that's in Babylon. This is how the Christians began to refer to the Roman Empire. Why? Because they knew Genesis 11 and these other passages. Here's the impulse again. And of course, God took down the Roman Empire primarily by giving them over to their own corruption till they were so weak that barbarians from the north chipped away at their empire and finally sacked Rome. This is going to be my opinion, and so that's why the question marks are there, but I would like to argue that the rise of Hitler was very evil, a man who explicitly rejected the God of the Bible, a man who aspired to worldwide rule, a man who propagated a merciless kind of nationalism and militarism that brought the whole world together into a war that almost wiped everything out. He got taken down. You could say, well, yeah, the Allies were stronger than Hitler. And that's true. That doesn't cancel out another deeper interpretation of the event, that God was working here to bring that evil empire to an end. I would argue the same motif with the same conclusion with the Soviet Russian Empire, again an explicitly anti-God empire, which expressly sought to bring the whole world under its rule. Merciless, cruel, brutal. Stalin murdered 35 million of his own people before World War II even started. People were amazed. Most of you were alive when it came tumbling down. People were like, man, how did it just fall apart? And again, you can say, well, Reagan and Star Wars outspent them and broke their economy. And that's true on one level. But from the biblical perspective, this is another Nimrod and another Babylon and another instance in which the God who really exists and who intervenes in human history to advance his plan intervenes in judgment and says, you're done for now. Well, we know that at the end of this age, there will be another Babylon led by another Nimrod. And in the scriptures, specifically in the last book of the Bible, Revelation, this empire is referred to as Mystery Babylon. Same code word, calling to mind the same motif. Mystery means hidden. In other words, a yet to come, yet hidden form of this same aspiration to unite the world in defiance of God. And this Mystery Babylon, we read, will be ruled by a real person who Paul tells us in 2 Thessalonians 2 will be energized by the serpent himself. It says he'll be energized by Satan, empowered to do signs, miracles, and wonders in order to bring people under his control. And Paul says there's been a restraining force at work to prevent this from happening, but that restraining force will be taken away for a little while so that he succeeds for a short while in doing what all of these other earlier Nimrods aspired to do but could not do. He will bring the world under his control, his economic control, his military control for a short time. And then guess what? It says very clearly in Daniel and in Revelation, then God will intervene in judgment that will culminate in the coming of the rightful ruler of the human race, the Messiah himself. Yeah, in Revelation 17, John says he had a series of visions. He says, then one of the seven angels came and spoke to me saying, come here, I'll show you the judgment of the great harlot who sits on the many waters. In other words, many waters referring to the oceans. This so-called woman, this prostitute, you'll see what he's referring to. It's a symbol, is slouched over the whole world, with whom the kings of the earth committed acts of immorality, and who those who dwell on the earth were made drunk with the wine of her immorality. And he carried me away in the spirit into a wilderness. And I saw a woman sitting on a scarlet beast full of blasphemous names and having in her hand a gold cup full of abominations and of the unclean things of her immorality. And on her forehead a name was written, a mystery, Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots and of the abominations of the earth. The harlotry spoken of here is spiritual harlotry. It's the idea of going a-whoring by worshiping other false gods. And so he's saying this empire will lead people into the spiritual abominations and the worship of false gods. And later we read in the next chapter, after these things, I saw another angel coming down from heaven, and he cried out with a mighty voice saying, fallen, fallen is Babylon the Great. And the kings of the earth who committed acts of immorality and who lived sensuously with her will weep and lament over her when they see the smoke of her burning, standing at a distance because of the fear of her torment, saying, woe, woe, the great city, Babylon, the great city, for in 1 hour your judgment has come. And then a strong angel took up a stone like a great millstone and threw it into the sea, saying, so will Babylon, the great city, be thrown down with violence and will not be found any longer. You ever taken a big old rock and thrown it in? I used to do that when I would vacation the Great Lakes. We'd pick these rocks up that were almost as big as we were, and we'd throw them over this deep pool, and it'd go, right? And you'd see a splash and ripples, but that rock was gone. It's like, that's what it'll be like. This empire, which vaunts its power, which everyone's afraid of and dependent on, God will step in and he'll take it out. It says he'll take it out. The next chapter then narrates how it's taken out. He sends the Messiah. And he comes, and it says, from the word of his mouth, the authority of his word will put this kingdom down. So, yeah, this is the beginning of that Babel project. This is the beginning of this account of human history that goes all the way back in the Bible that accords with what we know about human history in terms of this being a major theme. Instead of ending, though, with a nightmare, a dystopian nightmare, it ends with the defeat of this project and the installation of God's king. Now, that's the other thing that this event and this chapter teaches about how this passage fits into God's plan. See, here, what we've just talked about is simply one application of this universal law. God says throughout his word, he's opposed to the proud. That's what he's really against. He's against us setting ourselves up to be our own rulers. He's opposed to that. I mean, he's opposed to it in large part for our good, because it's suicidal to try to be your own God. But it says he gives grace, he gives mercy, he gives charity to the humble. And this passage, specifically the part following what we just read, ties into how it is that God can extend this grace to those of us who humble ourselves before him. And that is that God's Messiah will overcome this Babel project, and he will reverse the curse that lies over it. You remember the passage that we began with. He's going to send someone who will crush the serpent, who's the true author of the Babel Project. We learned last week that after the flood, one of the things God did was to identify who this seed, this coming one, who what line that person would be in. And that's why God said among the three sons of Noah, Shem, Ham, and Japheth, God says, I'm going to dwell in a unique way. I'm going to be part of the history of the Semites, in a unique way. He's identifying that as the line from which the seed, the Messiah, will come. Now that's why, you've probably been pondering this after poring over Genesis 11. You're like, you know, Gary, what I want to know is why after the story of the Tower of Babel does the record begin to trace the line of Shem's descendants? You've been thinking about that. Well, this is why. This is why. It says right after this story, now these are the records of the generations of Shem. And it names key highlight figures in Shem's line over a period of many centuries. And we get down later to Terah, who became the father of Abram, as well as Nahor and Haran. And the name of Abram's wife was Sarai. Sarai was barren. She had no child. Well, this sounds like a dead end. If the line is supposed to go through Shem down to Terah and to Abraham, and Abraham's wife can't have kids, we got a problem. And then we read that Terah took Abram his son and Sarah his daughter-in-law, and they went out together from Ur of the Chaldeans. This is where this story took place. That's where they lived. And they went out together from that place to enter the land of Canaan. They got as far as Haran, which is not all that far. They're here, Canaan's here, and they went here, and then they built a nice house. We'll read about that next week. But God, at a certain point, speaks to Abram. And he says, you know what? I'm going to make you a great nation. And I'm going to bless you, and I'm going to make your name great. Remember Nimrod? And the Nimrodites said, we'll make a name for ourselves. God says, I'm going to make your name great. I'm going to make you famous. He's pretty famous even till today, isn't he? And you will be a blessing. There's someone whose name is made great because they're a blessing to the world. In fact, in you or through you, or as the following texts say, through your descendants, all the families, all of the ethnic groups in the whole earth are going to be blessed. And so God is saying at this point, that seed of Eve that was going to come through Shem, it's going to now go right through Abraham. And of course, the rest of Genesis from 12 on is about the beginning of the people who became the Israelites, the 12 tribes. And we find later on in Genesis, God making a prophetic utterance about one of the tribes of Israel named Judah, and how from Judah will come this king, who's to whom the right of rulership belongs. And the story just keeps going, narrowing down as it goes through the rest of the Old Testament, until we're set up for the very beginning of the New Testament. And you've been thinking about this too. When you read the New Testament and you begin with Matthew, you're fascinated that Matthew begins with a genealogy of Jesus. That says he's the descendant of David, who's the descendant of Abraham. Saying he's the coming one whose descent was predicted all the way back there. So you see, even as God intervenes to squash the Babel project so that humans won't destroy themselves, he's also at the same time advancing this other plan. You say, well, he's fractured humanity into a bunch of nations. Yeah, he's got that covered. He's already got someone picked out from one of those nations that descend from Shem, and he's already decided that through that person, he's going to make available through the Messiah a blessing for the whole world, every nation. You say, oh, the Old Testament's all about how the Jews are the bomb. No one else counts. They're even called the chosen people. They're called the chosen people because they were chosen to be the people through whom God gave his word, and through whom he gave his Messiah, who loves the whole world, and who came to forgive every human being who humbles himself before him. We read that when this Messiah comes back at the end, one of the things that is going to happen, according to Zephaniah, is at that time, I will change the speech of the peoples to a pure speech, that all of them may call together upon the name of the Lord and serve him with one accord. What is this? This is the reversal of the Babel curse. There won't be any need for God to keep nations separated, because the people who are there are people who've humbled themselves to him. They will be enabled to all speak the same language and learn together about God and serve God. This is why, after Jesus came the first time, not to establish God's kingdom, because if he did, no one would be eligible to enter it. Because none of our sins would have been paid for. But when he sent him the first time, as he said, to come and live, give his life as a ransom for many, he said, now, let me tell you what I'm doing in this next era of history. Is that I'm going to work through the people who have received me. And through them, I want them to communicate to the rest of the ethno-linguistic groups in the world about what I've done. That's the stage of history we live in. The resurrected Christ said the Messiah, the scriptures said that the Messiah would suffer and rise again from the dead the third day, and that repentance, which just means humbling yourself, repentance for the forgiveness of sins should be proclaimed in his name to all the nations beginning from Jerusalem. God's like, in this age, I want my followers to take the message of what Jesus has done and put it in the language of people who haven't heard it yet. You know that we're pretty close to being done with that. We'll talk more about this next week. We're pretty close to that project being completed. It's pretty amazing. And I think this is why, in conclusion, on the birth of the church, we read that on that day, when the day of Pentecost had come, they were all together in one place. You know this story. The Pentecostals like to show it to us. And they were all filled with the Holy Spirit and began to speak with other tongues or languages as the Spirit was giving them utterance. I've heard so many people lean on me about, you know, you need to get this so that you can speak in an angelic language. That's not what's going on here. It says, now there were Jews living in Jerusalem, devout men from every nation under heaven. He details the nations. Guess what? Those nations line up with the nations described in Genesis 10 and 11. And when this sound occurred of people all speaking, so there you're with your Hebrew friends, used to praying in Hebrew, talking to each other about Jesus, and suddenly you start talking in French or German or whatever, and they're looking at you like the guy on the building crane. They can't understand you. But the other people who were there as pilgrims for the day of Pentecost, it says, they came together and they were bewildered because each one of them was hearing these folks speak in their own native language. We hear them in our own language speaking of the mighty deeds of God, what God has done through his son Jesus. So what is this? This is the beginning of the reverse of Babel. All right? God's like, I'm gonna take my good news through my followers to people who can't speak that language so that they can understand it in their own language. That is a picture of what the mission of the church is. I think it's pretty cool. We thank you that we can get in on your plan so simply. Thank you that you say that if we just humble ourselves and admit we need your forgiveness, that you're going to give it to us through your Son. And then you said, then we can play a role in your plan, and that you've actually got roles prepared for us from long beforehand. What an amazing thing that I could have a role in your plan. And thank you that you extend that to each and every one of us. Amen.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.